Okay, we start with discrimination against homeless people with disabilities. How much to say about that? Two people are scheduled for this. We hope we find both of them. But we have one. And we're going to talk about what can be done to address the question of discrimination against people who have not just one, but a number of disadvantages. Homelessness being one of them, disability being one. And ordinarily with homelessness, there is also poverty. And if you put all that together, it is a challenge. I would ordinarily not take much time to introduce our panel members because the idea is that we get a chance to talk about the topic. And so I leave to you the opportunity to read about the people who are making presentations, very fine people and lots of friends of mine, you'll find, and some who I hope are becoming friends soon. The person we will hear from first this morning is an attorney at Mental Hygiene Legal Service. Here is Naomi Weinstein.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm very honored to be speaking about these important issues. So my name is Naomi Weinstein. I work for an agency called Mental Hygiene Legal Service. Just very briefly, we are a state agency in New York, divided into the different appellate division departments. We represent people with psychiatric mental disabilities who are in psychiatric facilities for issues of medication or trying to get released from the hospital. We also represent persons who are facing guardianships. We represent them if they do not want a guardian, or sometimes we act as court evaluator, which is more of like an investigatory role. And we also represent sex offenders facing civil commitment. And we also do work with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are living in facilities that are licensed by the state of New York. So my co-panelist, Ms. Foscarini, she's going to speak more about broadly homelessness, what we mean by that, the intersection of homelessness and disability, barriers to services, and also the criminalization of homelessness and litigation that her organization is working on. My topic is a little bit more narrow. I'm gonna be primarily focusing on people with mental disabilities, as that's primarily what my work focuses on. But I really think that this issue of continuity of care, it's not just limited to people with mental disabilities. It's something really that everyone faces. The issue of poverty, of homelessness. I work primarily in the Bronx, and I would say the number one issue that our clients face is finding affordable housing, finding housing that will accommodate their disabilities. And oftentimes what we see in our practice is that supportive housing that is designated for people with mental disabilities, they are quick sometimes to kick those people out once problematic issues arise, and when the person is hospitalized, they then try to dictate that person's care. For example, we see the residents telling the doctors, well, we'll only take this person back if they're on this medication, or we'll only take this person back if they're on mandated outpatient treatment. And it's very difficult because, again, it's hard to find housing. So I think it's just an extra layer of discrimination that people face. So I would also, it's a little bit tangential to what I'll be focusing on, but I think there is often a jump to guardianships whenever somebody is facing eviction as a way to stop the eviction and then sort of just impose a lot of restrictions on this person's life. And I think that in general, there has to be a better way to support people to make sure that their housing accommodates them, and to make sure that if, you know, things change and they're living in a walk-up and they suddenly need a, you know, first-floor apartment, that somehow those accommodations are met, that people aren't kicked off of their Section 8 benefits because suddenly they forget to renew, that there's help in doing those benefits so that they're not just lost. So what do I mean by continuity of care? So by continuity of care, I mean the issue of making sure that there is continuity of control over your medical decisions, continuity of the social environment, continuity of attachment, continuity of service and program content. One big issue that we see, that I've seen in our work, and I think it's, again, a global issue, is that there's a lot of this cycle between people in the community to the hospital to sometimes jail to community to hospital. And between those shuttles, people lose housing. They become homeless. They are incarcerated. They lose benefits. There's a lot of detrimental things that can happen in that shuttle between the various places. And in between then, if somebody goes on and off medication, sometimes they're suddenly trying on completely new medication, or they're trying to say, I'll take this medication but not that medication, and the doctor's saying, oh, no, I want you to try it on this. So what I'm trying to talk about in my part of the presentation is, you know, what is the current state of affairs? Using some case examples that I've had, what are the legal arguments that support continuity of care? And what are the legal issues that can complicate continuity of care? And then finally, I'll discuss some strategies to hopefully improve continuity of care. So I'll start a little bit about the sort of current state of affairs. We know that mental illness affects, I think, about 44 million people in the United States. I think that some statistics say about 1 in 4 people suffer from mental disability. We also know that jails have unfortunately become de facto mental health institutions. And that is a real problem because there can be a lack of training. They're not really properly equipped to handle people with mental disabilities, and they're not necessarily making accommodations for the people or making sure that they are screened so that there's an understanding about behavior. It's not just about not following the rules and being, obstinate or difficult. It's about suffering from an illness that requires compassion and treatment. And, you know, some of our clients, and again, I think Ms. Fiscarina will speak about this, are really criminalized for homelessness, basically, trespassing, minor issues, but they get stuck, or minor assaults, and they get stuck in the jail system, I think, because there is I think deinstitutionalization is often blamed for that, wrongly. I don't think that this issue is because we no longer keep people in state hospitals, you know, for years on end without review. No, I think the issue is that we don't have the appropriate community support to help these people stay in the community, have the support they need so that they aren't repeatedly hospitalized, so that they aren't criminalized for trespassing or minor issues. So I think another issue is that there is a privatization of medical care. And so there is a push by medical insurance to limit length of stays. I thought that was very interesting. I used to only represent clients mostly in a long-term state hospital, but recently I started doing acute care hospital. And I was surprised to learn that insurers sometimes can drive length of stay. They can drive what medication what medication is covered. So it can sort of hinder a psychiatrist's ability to treat these people. There's another issue that has happened since deinstitutionalization. Besides the lack of community support, there's also something that's been termed trans-institutionalization, where it's just moving one person from another setting. So again, it can be the jail setting, or it can be, you know, adult homes that are not proper, that are not giving people the freedom and the dignity that they deserve. I just want to make sure. So I think I have a brief case example that can really show sort of the breakdown of what happens and why it's so frustrating. I had a client, not his real name, I'm calling him Billy, and he was institutionalized in a long-term state hospital. While on the unit, he assaulted a staff member and was given a desk appearance ticket, which is a lower level. You're not sent to central booking. Usually, if you're in the community, you just go to the police department. He was arraigned and brought to the state trial court, and he acted out in court. And so even though he was in the hospital and brought by hospital staff and would have been returned to the hospital, the judge remanded him to jail. And so he was sent to Rikers, where he was not provided the right psychiatric medication, stopped taking medication, began to deteriorate. During that time, he was then waiting an evaluation to determine whether he was competent to stand trial. Eventually, he was transferred to a psychiatric ward where he was treated for his mental illness. And over the course of several months, he was evaluated twice to determine whether he was competent to stand trial. It was a misdemeanor charge. And so in New York, if you're found to be incompetent to stand trial and it's a misdemeanor, the charges are often dropped and you're sent to a hospital for evaluation. You know, that's what happened in Billy's case, but the irony is that he was in jail for far longer than he ever would have been if he just pled guilty. It was tough because it was a complete, basically, start over of his care once he returned to the state institutionalization. And the unfortunate part is there was a big gap about when this incident occurred, when he was arraigned. He started to actually improve and was about to be discharged, and then because of the stress of court, because of everything that happened, he really had to start at square one when he returned to the hospital. Now that things have changed, we are happy to report that, you know, we do have more liaisons within the Rikers. So if one of our clients does get sent there, we are able to contact them. We are able to give them a heads up so that hopefully they will receive treatment. There is now a New York City law that says you have to do mental health screening for every person who enters the jail system. So there are improvements, but it's this case, which is not an outlier, that shows really why continuity of care is so important and how it can really disrupt someone's lives. Again, this came up, you know, the issue in his case, he didn't have housing. When you're on an app, you know, he had an application for housing, but once you're discharged to a jail, you lose your spot, you lose your placement, you have to start all over. And we see that a lot in the long-term state hospital. Just yesterday, my colleague had a case where really the hospital was only keeping him to find housing, but if the person doesn't agree to staying, they don't meet criteria. There's no legal reason to keep someone against their will. So again, when you are homeless and you have suffer from a mental disability, it's just an extra layer of another barrier, another hindrance. So some of the arguments that support continuity of care is, I would say, of course, the American with Disabilities Act, and of course, the landmark case Olmstead versus LC XREL Zimring, where, you know, I'm sure everybody knows that the Supreme Court held unjustified isolation as discrimination based on disability, and that the ADA requires the state to provide community-based treatment. The Supreme Court has also said that this extends to prison inmates. What the Supreme Court has not decided is whether this applies to arrests themselves. Lower courts have been split about whether the ADA does apply to arrests. And I would say that, you know, there's a lot of research out there that supports why continuity of care is important, how it leads to better outcomes, how it leads to less hospitalizations and gives people more determination of their rights and their outcomes. Some issues, and also I would argue that it's supported by the United Nations Convention for Rights with Persons with Disabilities. You know, that always talks about the right to health care, the right to, you know, be free from discrimination. And I would, you know, although unfortunately the U.S. has not ratified or signed the CRPD, which is another issue, I think that, you know, there are ways that it can be incorporated into legal practice for people who are attorneys out there. And it's important to remember, you know, that the tenets of the convention, that, you know, there's an inherent right to dignity, that there's freedom from, you know, torture, cruel, inhumane, degrading treatment, freedom from exploitation, violence, and abuse, that all parties should have access to justice and treatments and free and affordable health care and programs, and that the health services should require early identification, intervention as appropriate, and services designed to minimize and prevent further disabilities, and really to encourage people to have the most freedom and support their decisions, not to impose decisions on them, but to give them the ability to live their lives independently with support if needed. There are some legal issues that complicating the continuity of care, and ironically, I had a case in court yesterday where it was under the guise of continuity of care, and I did tell the other side, I said, I'm talking about continuity of care, but there is a way to effectuate continuity of care that does not infringe on persons' rights. So I feel very strongly that continuity of care should never override individual rights, especially the right to medical privacy and the right to refuse treatment. So in the context of yesterday's case, without getting into the minutiae and boring everybody, this was an application by a long-term state hospital seeking to transfer a patient to have another hospital where he's going to be transferred and administer psychiatric treatment and medical treatment, specifically hemodialysis. And our argument was there's a proper way to do this, and you haven't done it properly, and that it should be his treating doctors, the ones who are actually going to be administering the treatment, who should be making that determination if you're going to override his ability to refuse this treatment. So despite, you know, what the other side was saying, I was not arguing against continuity because the hospital presented it as a continuity of care issue. But again, I think that there is a proper way to do it that doesn't infringe on persons' individual rights. You know, HIPAA governs whether covered entities like hospitals or medical facilities can disclose PHI. Of course, you as the person have the right to waive that. You know, I think in terms of medical care and certainly in terms of emergency care, doctors can have access to your medical information. As I had touched upon before, health insurance can also dictate what's available, what's not available. So that can be a hindrance. And in New York, there's a database called the Psychiatric Services and Clinical Knowledge Enhancement System, PSYCES is what we call it. And it's a database that covers only people who are under Medicaid and allows doctors to quickly search information such as a history of outpatient, inpatient services, what medications they were prescribed, and what labs were performed. I think there's some issues with that because it only covers people with Medicaid and not people with private insurance. There's no sort of waiver that people sign into when they, you know, to allow this information to be readily available. And I know in particular our agency has a problem because we don't have access to it even though doctors testify to it. And it's contained in their record. Another thing I wanted to touch upon is just briefly is advanced psychiatric directives, which are can be used to address the issue of continuity of care. It can help people determine, much like healthcare proxy, well, a little bit different than healthcare proxies because it's a little bit more specific, but it can specify both who should make treatment decisions, what specific treatment can be administered, including psychiatric medication, in the event of incapacity. In theory, it should follow the person, but they are allowed to revoke it. And it can have therapeutic value because people are able to determine their own care. There are potentially problems with it if, for example, a doctor wouldn't honor it, or if someone were to change their minds while in a hospital and the hospital determined that they're not capacitated to make that decision, could it be used, again, to override their individual right to refuse? Could it be used instead of being able to challenge that issue in court? But I think ideally, in an ideal world, these directives could be used to help this issue of continuity of care. So some strategies to, just want to make sure I'm still on time. So some strategies to help address the issue of continuity of care. Just want to talk briefly about therapeutic jurisprudence, which is the idea that, you know, law, there's a therapeutic value in the way that the law is applied, that it's important to give everyone voice and validation. And certainly we see that in our work, that, you know, the court process itself can often have a therapeutic value in that it gives our clients a voice. You know, the courts are very respectful and give all of our clients, you know, a chance to say their reasons for, you know, why they want to be released or why they don't want to take the medication. You know, it's a focus on procedural justice, restorative justice. And I think that maybe people don't always use the term therapeutic jurisprudence, but I think if you talk to a lot of lawyers who are in this area of work, they utilize the principles of therapeutic jurisprudence in their practice, in terms of making sure that their clients' voices are heard, that their, you know, that their wishes are known. Another way that could possibly improve outcomes is diversion, and that can be diversion through mental health courts if you are subject to criminal proceedings. It can be diversion in the sense of being screened when you're arrested. Again, it's about identifying early on to hopefully help people not get stuck in this loop of jail, prison, community. And I think the major thing, especially when it comes to homelessness, is improving community services and access to housing to make sure that people are not kicked out because they have, you know, one minor incident. You know, to make sure that if people are in shelters, that they are still receiving care and support, that their services are connected, and, you know, that it's not like starting anew every time you see a new doctor. And again, I think while a lot of my talk has been focused on persons with mental disabilities, I really think that this happens to everybody. You know, it shouldn't be so hard to switch medical providers. If you have an emergency and you see a new doctor, it shouldn't be like reinventing the wheel or, you know, facing discrimination because the doctors just assume you don't have the capacity to make this decision. So again, I think that there needs to be a real movement, I think, to look at this cycle and how can we break it and look at the issue of homelessness and how can we support people in the community better? How can we help people live independently? How can we make sure that they maintain their dignity, that they maintain their rights? So I don't want to infringe too much because I know. but I think we're going to reserve questions till the end. But certainly open to questions later if you see me. Please grab me. Thank you.
Thank you, Naomi. We now have the founder and executive director of the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. Once again, a very extensive biographical write-up is available. You may look at that. We won't take time to go over it. Here is Maria Fascarinas.
Great. Thank you very much.
Can I say it right?
You said it perfectly and with a flourish. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thank you, Naomi, and thank you all for hosting this wonderful event and symposium. I'm so happy to be here. I had a bit of a harrowing trip coming up from Washington, D.C. this morning, but I am here, and I am happy to follow Naomi to kind of step back a little bit and broaden the lens. We've heard about some of the very specific and important aspects of being homeless and also mentally disabled or disabled generally. I want to step back and talk a little bit about homelessness in general. I'll give you a little bit of a two-minute national overview, and then talk a little bit about some of the current trends today and discrimination faced by homeless people, especially what we call the criminalization of homelessness, some important advocacy that we and others are doing, and including some key court decisions, and hopefully end by talking about our campaign and invite you to join us in that campaign. So first, little introduction, the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, which I founded 30 years ago. Our mission is to use the power of the law to end and prevent homelessness in the United States. We feel that homelessness to exist in a country with the wealth that ours has is intolerable, and it's a human rights violation, and it must and can be ended and prevented. That's our mission, and the law can be a very powerful tool towards that mission, and that's what we do. Our vision is for an end to homelessness, that housing is a right that everybody should have, and it's not something that is a privilege. So I guess I'd like to start with a question. It's often said homelessness has always been with us. How many people in the room, can I get a show of hands, do you think homelessness has always been with us? Okay. So, a lot of people think this. Not all, I'm glad to see that. So homelessness, in fact, at least in its current form, in its mass form, has not always been with us. Homelessness first became a mass, and I'm talking about modern day homelessness. I mean, this country has had periods of mass homelessness, for example, during the Great Depression. But I'm talking about current modern day homelessness really started in the early 1980s. And it started before then, it existed, but it was pretty limited in terms of the population affected and the parts of the country affected. There were skid rows, there were people often known as hobos, but it was not a mass phenomenon like it is today. And it really started in the early 80s, and one of the primary drivers was the cuts imposed by then President Reagan. And housing in particular suffered extreme cuts. So the federal government used to fund significant numbers of affordable housing for poor people, low-income housing. Just to give you a sense, in the 1978, the number was about over 300,000 new units each year of low-income housing. And then 3 or 4 years later, 1982, that number was down to 3,000 per year. So this was a massive, massive cut that is often not, that has not gotten a lot of attention. It was a massive cut, and it came on the heels of loss of inexpensive housing in the private market. So you may be familiar with the term SRO, single room occupancy housing, which is a form of inexpensive housing often used by disabled people. There was a loss of over 1 million units in the 1970s alone. So these two trends together resulted in the loss of a tremendous resource that kept poor people housed. And it's a loss that continues to this day. It has not been made up. Other cuts to social welfare programs, notably cuts, or not just cuts, making it more difficult to get benefits. This was particularly the case with SSI and SSDI, which are especially important for people who are poor and suffer and disabled in some way. And this was litigated, but it remains extremely difficult to get these benefits, to the point that many homeless people are eligible for these benefits and few actually receive them. So these are trends that started then, but they continue to this day, and basically they come down to lack of affordable housing and lack of adequate income to pay for it. And, you know, factor into that the minimum wage, which has not kept up with the cost of living, and factor into that also payments under SSI or SSDI, which are not adequate, not sufficient to pay for housing. So there's a huge gap between income and housing, and that is the primary driver of modern-day homelessness. And that is how it started, and those continue to be the primary drivers. Right now, federal funding for low-income housing is so inadequate that only one in four of poor people, people who are poor enough to be eligible for federal low-income housing assistance, actually receives it. So one in four. That means that three in four are out of luck, and they're on waiting lists that are years long in many cities around the country. Private market gentrification continues to eliminate low-income housing. You can see tremendous development in cities around the country that is displacing people and not providing housing for people who are poor, or sometimes even for people who are middle income. So these are the drivers. Right now, what is the landscape of homelessness right now? So right now, depending on who you ask, between 1.5 and over 7 million people are homeless each year in this country. And it depends on who you ask, because there are different definitions and different ways of counting the population. So HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, takes a very narrow definition of homelessness. The Department of Education has a broader definition. And counting methods are flawed. But the bottom line is it depends on whether you consider people to be homeless if they're just people who are in a shelter or living on the street or in another public place, or if you also take into account people who are doubled up with friends and family because they have been evicted and cannot afford their own place. People who are doubled up due to economic necessity. So that's why there's a variation in the numbers. But the numbers, regardless, are too large. And by many accounts, they are growing. More people are becoming homeless. More people are unstably housed. And that's because of the continuation of these trends that I talked about. Now, what about disability? I mentioned this as part of the driving cause, the cuts in disability benefits. There's an intersection between homelessness and disability in many ways. Disabled people are disproportionately represented among the homeless population. People with disabilities make up 16% of the overall population, but over 40% of homeless people. So that's a big gap. This is not limited to this kind of overrepresentation. Also applies to other groups of people, like there's an overrepresentation of people of color in the homeless population. African Americans make up 12% of the overall population and 40% of the homeless population. So there's a lot of disproportionality in who becomes homeless, and that's not surprising. There's disproportionality in the poverty population, but it's even more so in the homeless population. And it's because of who these causal factors, these trends, impacts the most. So what are the resources that are available? A lot of people think, well, you know, sure, we have homelessness, but there's shelters for everybody, you know, and people who are not in shelters just don't choose not to go there. Well, in fact, this is not the case. There's not even, first of all, shelter, we don't consider that shelter is the solution to homelessness. Shelter at best is a temporary stopgap. The solution is housing, permanent affordable housing. But even if we talk about shelter, is there enough shelter? Well, no, there is not. No matter how you count the homeless population, even if you look at HUD's counts, which are very tend to grossly underestimate the numbers, there's not enough shelter space for the homeless population. As a result, 35% of people who are homeless are unsheltered. That means people are living on the streets, they're living in parks, they're living under bridges and abandoned buildings and caves in rural areas, in all kinds, on subways, in urban areas, all kinds of public places. And this, the numbers of people who are unsheltered are growing. Even according to HUD's counts, they're growing. According to other measures, they are growing. So a couple of years ago, my organization produced a report looking at tent cities across the country. Tent cities, when we talk about tent cities, or sometimes we call them homeless encampments, we're talking about groups of people who are unsheltered, who are living together outside, forming communities, living outside. And we found that we did a look over 10 years using a proxy measure and found an increase of over 1,300% over 10 years in reported encampments of homeless people across the country. So that is huge, and that is probably also an underestimate. Again, a significant intersection with disability, because people who are disabled are not only more likely to be homeless, they're also more likely to be unsheltered. So a huge intersection with people disproportionately represented among the unsheltered homeless population. And once people are unsheltered, when they're living in public spaces, that can have very deleterious health effects. Whatever health problems someone has can get worse. It is hard to treat somebody who is living in public. It's hard to maintain a medication regimen or to get access, reliable access to medical care, or even hold on to basic items like medication or medical documentation. So health crisis, disability status can create the risk of homelessness, but it can also exacerbate it once it happens. So what can we do? It's not that nothing has been done. I should say that before I go further. You know, in the early 80s, during the Reagan era, we worked towards getting the federal government to respond as this national crisis emerged. And I was part of that effort. It was a big advocacy movement that involved a lot of different groups and a lot of different pieces and strategies. The result was that in 1987, Congress enacted the first and still only major federal legislation addressing homelessness, the McKinney-Venta Homeless Assistance Act. That act focuses primarily on emergency relief. So much of the funding was for, and is still, for emergency shelter and other forms of emergency aid. However, over the years, we've worked to strengthen the act, to make it, to increase funding for it, and we've also worked to get other of the mainstream social welfare programs to amend their statutes in order to address the problem of homelessness. And we've had success on all those fronts, but not enough success to solve the problem. And this was never, the McKinney-Vento Act was never intended to be the solution to homelessness. It was intended to be a first emergency step. And the real solution is increasing the commitment to affordable housing. And that is something that remains on our agenda and remains an unfulfilled promise. So that means that that's why we're in this situation now where we have some emergency relief, not enough, and certainly not enough to stop the not enough in the way of permanent solutions to stop the influx of people who are becoming homeless. So we've got this growing number of people who are unsheltered around the country. And we also have this trend in the past decade plus of cities responding to the influx, to the presence, the public presence of people on their streets by not only by not providing resources, but by criminalizing their public presence. So by criminalization, I mean passing laws, and these are usually city laws, that make it illegal, that make it a crime to sleep in public, to sit down in a public place, to rest in public, to ask others for help in public, to eat in public. There are all manner of permutations of these laws. And my organization has documented this extensively. We have national reports that look at, we've been looking at the same 187 cities for over 10 years. So we have national data and trends about these laws, and we've documented significant increases over the past decade plus. One of the most compelling or telling increases has been in the number of laws that make it illegal to sleep in your car. That those laws increased 143% in the past decade. So that tells us something about people who are losing their homes, moving into their cars, and cities responding by making it a crime to do so. Why are cities doing this? Well, it's cities are feeling under tremendous pressure to do something about the fact that these there are so many desperately poor people living in their downtowns, in their midst. They're often under pressure from businesses, from other city residents. And so what they do is a kind of quick fix, which is pass a law making it illegal. Problem solved, right? Problem with people sleeping in public in your downtown, well, just make it illegal. Problem with that is it doesn't solve the problem. People have to be somewhere, and they tend to then just move somewhere else. And it's also obviously inhumane. People who are caught up in what are called sweeps, often lose their possessions. They lose things that are vital to them. They can lose their birth certificates, other vital documentation. They can lose their medications, things that they need to live, to survive. Also, things that they need if they are trying to get out of homelessness. You need an ID. You need documentation of who you are. It makes it harder for people to get out of homelessness in other ways, too. For example, getting a job, getting into housing, even getting public benefits becomes much harder if you also have, you're not only homeless, but you also have a criminal conviction or an arrest record. So this is a kind of cycle that Naomi talked about of people then cycling through the criminal justice system because they are homeless. And it's a particularly egregious example of this because they're being punished simply because they have no home, simply because they have no place to live. The theme of the conference is stigma. Well, stigma has something to do with this. Why is this allowed to happen? Well, public attitudes about who homeless people are. You want me to
wrap it up in a couple of minutes?
Couple of minutes, okay. So stigma has something to do with this, and it allows it to happen. What are we doing? I've got to wrap up, so let me cut to the chase. Part of what we're doing is we have a campaign called Housing Not Handcuffs. We believe that housing is the solution, not criminalization. And we're pursuing this in various ways. We just had a big court victory in the Ninth Circuit where we got a great court decision that said that it is unconstitutional to punish someone because they are homeless. So it's unconstitutional to impose a sleeping ban when there's no alternative in that particular case. But the ruling has big significance. Ninth Circuit covers 9 states. We're using this now to say to cities, look, you can't arrest your way out of homelessness. Let's work together to help you develop some more constructive solutions that are based in housing, which actually does end homelessness. We're in this campaign, we're inviting other organizations to endorse it, to join us. We have a listserv that's very active. We have a lawyers group that made up of lawyers who are litigating these kinds of cases. And we have an annual event that we put on that brings everybody together. And you can find out about the campaign and endorse it by going on to our website, nlchp.org. And the campaign also has a separate website, housingnothandcuffs.org. And we've got over 800 endorsements. We'd love to have you all endorse. We are bringing together law enforcement to support us because there are many people in law enforcement who are starting to realize that deploying the police to arrest people simply because they're so poor they're homeless doesn't make sense. And it's also poor use of their resources and a very expensive, in fact, more expensive than solving the problem than by providing housing. So that is our campaign. There are other pieces to it, but I think I'm out of time. We've got some federal advocacy going. We have human rights advocacy going before human rights bodies. But I think I've given you the critical pieces and would love to hear your questions if we have time for that.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so those of you who've been here before know that we have a roving microphone, and we also have the plan that you will express your name, indicating who you are if you want to ask a question. We have 11 minutes, and I can think of about 20 questions, but anyway, let's see if there are some in the audience. Tell me who you are. And Naomi and Maria, if you'll take the microphones on the tables. Anybody have any questions?
Leslie Francis.
Come ahead, Leslie.
Hi. Thank you very much. This was great. To what extent, neither one of you mentioned opioid issues and drug issues, and you know, one of the problems with federal housing policy is the question of whether or not you can get access to subsidies if you've got any kind of drug conviction history, or even in some states, if you're a legal user of marijuana. And I wonder if you could comment on the extent to which those issues have played into the problems that you see.
Which of you would like to address this?
So the opioid crisis is significant. I'm glad you brought that point up. And certainly also the restrictions on people who have a drug history in public housing. And these are important drivers for part of the homeless population now. But I didn't mention this not because it's not important, it's just that I see this as coming within the overarching issue of lack of resources. There are not enough resources for housing, period, and for anyone. And there's not enough resources to respond to the opioid crisis. It's not an issue that my organization has worked on specifically. So, and not because it's not important, but because there are a lot of important issues and we have only so much capacity. But if you have something more to say, I'm happy to hear it.
I mean, I would just add that, you know, it just, I think, adds another barrier, another layer of possible discrimination, another barrier to housing. We do see a lot of people who do use substances. What's very common, at least in the Bronx, is synthetic marijuana. And that can create a lot of issues. There just isn't as much programming. Just what I've anecdotally noticed in my, I think I've worked at MHLs almost for 10 years now, like there's just not as much programming or support for the mental health and substance abuse programming. It's just, it used to be, for example, with mandated outpatient treatment, it used to be that you would go, if you had these issues, there were programs that you could go to that were available, and we just don't see it anymore. So it's certainly an important issue that we, you know, our organization doesn't directly, but we see it with our clients.
Other questions?
Hi, this is Claudia with the National ACLU Disability Rights Program. I'm wondering how the campaign against homelessness, how your campaign uses the principles of the ADA and disability rights in your work, and if you use ADA claims in your litigation strategy. Thanks.
Great question, and something I just didn't get to, but yes, we are making, we are working with disability rights advocates, and we are just, we recently filed a lawsuit in San Diego with California Disability Rights, where we did, and this was challenging a city ordinance that made it illegal to live in your recreational vehicle, and many of our plaintiffs are people who are disabled and who don't have access to shelters, or for whom shelters are not an option. And living, for people who still have their RVs, that is, it's not, certainly not ideal, but it is an option. And they were being ticketed, they were being fined, their vehicles were being impounded. And so we got together with Disability Rights California and filed litigation. One of our claims was under the ADA, yes, and the Rehabilitation Act. We won on the on our motion for preliminary injunction, but the court did not address the disability claims. It addressed just our constitutional claims.
Other questions?
So this is Victoria Rodriguez-Roldan from the National LGBTQ Task Force.
Go ahead.
As we all know, you didn't expand on the the intersection of disability and how it disproportionately impacts LGBTQ people and people of color. I'm wondering if you could expand on that and that intersection with disability for the benefit of the audience.
I can respond to that. So yes, you're right. There is an intersection there, and there's lots of intersections with homelessness and other issues, and this is one of them. The place that we have specifically focused is on homeless youth, where about 40% of homeless youth are members of the LGBTQ community, and that is a huge percentage and a huge issue, and there is discrimination there. We do put out legal resources focusing on the legal rights of homeless youth, and which vary state by state, but that is available. We've just published two big 50 state reviews on that issue. The broader issue of the intersection with the homeless population at large is not something I've looked at or we've looked at specifically, but certainly that is an intersection that's important.
So here's what bothers me about this. I wasn't going to do this, but anyway. The trend is that the homelessness is on the rise. The story is that the workplace is becoming smaller. That is to say, we have full employment today, which is an astonishing thing to me, except there are a lot of people who aren't looking for work who could get it. And then there is the story that the jobs that are out there are going away, they're going to be automated, and they'll be gone. If you put all those trends together, homelessness will be endemic, and it will be enormous in the very near future. What to do about that?
Is that a question for us? I'm happy to.
That's what I was hoping to have you tell me.
Okay. So I guess I would say a couple of things. I think what you're describing is the income piece, of which is one of the key drivers of homelessness, that inadequate incomes. We might be at full employment, supposedly. There's the question of people who are just simply not counted, which is critical. So those figures may be suspect. But there's also the question of what kind of employment. I mean, people working service jobs, people working at minimum wage, there's data that shows that if you're working a minimum wage job, there's no place in the country where you can afford housing based on federal affordability guidelines, which say you're only supposed to be paying 30% of income for housing. As a result, many people are paying 50% and even 80% of their incomes for housing, which puts them at imminent risk of homelessness. So what do we do? Well, this is not unique to homelessness. This is about fighting for living wage. It's about fighting for housing to be a right that everybody has and not something that is dependent on federal, state, or local budgets each year and that is subject to cuts. So this is part of making this more about human rights, that everybody has essential human rights. And that's why we're applying a human rights lens to our work and working towards the human right to housing. And this, I believe that this is possible. You know, we've just witnessed how the conversation about healthcare has moved in the direction of people talking now about how healthcare as a right and not a privilege. And I think we can have that same conversation. This is something we've been pushing for a long time, but it is starting to bubble up that housing is also a right. And there are other, if we look at human rights laws, there are other things that are rights, like the right to earn a basic standard of living. So I think we've got to make common cause and push for this different way of viewing these issues.
I mean, I think the start is also recognizing that this is a problem. Certainly the cutting of state and local benefits, I know that causes a lot of our clients to lose housing for our clients who aren't able to work. And you know, I think that, again, I would say it all comes back to community support and housing and awareness. And I think that there is going to be a boiling point where, you know, this problem really can't be ignored anymore, especially in some place like New York City that's so expensive. You talked about doubling up. That's so common for clients that we deal with across the spectrum, including guardianship clients who are at risk of eviction. You know, it's just not sustainable.
Maria and Naomi, I appreciate very much your coming. I hope you can stay a while, and I hope that there'll be an opportunity for those who have many questions. I have some more, but I'll hold them. Can talk to you maybe at lunch or sometime in the breaks. It is a problem that I remember talking to a man from a major corporation, and he said, the disabled, they're like the poor. They're with us always. And I got, this annoyed me enormously. I thought, you are saying that this is unmanageable, that there's no way to address this problem, and I do not believe it. And so I gave him a piece of my mind, and I don't know, it made me feel better anyway. And some of the people who were with me at the time said it was a good thing to have done. So be that as it may, this has to have a solution. We start with the proposition that you can do something about it. That's what this symposium is about, so please stick around and answer questions if you can find people who would still like to know more about what you know. Thank you very much for being with us.